As a general rule, vegetarians exclude meat, fish and chicken from their diet. Although a pesco vegetarian excludes meat and poultry, they still eat fish. Lacto-ovo vegetarians include dairy and eggs, whereas vegans exclude them all. When people find out that I don't eat meat, they often ask about nutritional deficiencies like iron and protein. There is sufficient protein in whole grains and legumes, and plenty of easily absorbable iron in well-cooked green leafy vegetables. And the body can actually overdose on the iron found in meat, and this is thought to contribute to cancer. On the other hand, there are nutrients that are limited in a vegetarian diet, and on today's show, we're going to talk about those. Go Healthy for Good starts right now. I'm Dr. Nerida. Welcome to Go Healthy for Good. It's not only vegetarians who are at risk of nutrient deficiencies, but they are at particular risk for some. What are they? How can you tell if you are deficient? And which foods contain those nutrients? These questions and more coming right up. We bring this special series to you from the International Congress on Vegetarian Nutrition held at Loma Linda University, California. Here's Dr. Mark Messina, an internationally recognized expert on the health effects of soy. I asked him how soy consumption impacts women's health.
Well, overall, soy is, I think, very important for women to consume, especially postmenopausal women. It can help to improve their arteries. It can help to reduce their blood pressure and also their cholesterol levels. So there's a lot of reasons for women of all ages to consume soy, but especially postmenopausal women. Of course, the most controversial area is whether soy increases risk of breast cancer or decreases it. So there's a lot of concern and confusion in that area. I think there's good news in a way, and that is that I do believe that soy reduces breast cancer risk, but to derive this particular benefit, I think it's necessary to consume soy during childhood and or adolescence. Now, the really good news is that the evidence suggests consuming as little as one serving per day, such as a cup of soy milk, may reduce breast cancer risk by as much as 25 to 50% later on in life. So I strongly recommend that all young girls consume at least one serving of soy per day. Now, on the flip side, there's been this controversy for more than 10 years now as to how soy affects breast cancer patients. Is it contraindicated for breast cancer patients, or should they consume it? Can they consume a little bit? We really didn't have good information to be able to answer this question until the last couple of years. The most recent evidence, and it's very impressive because it actually includes, the larger study includes about 10,000 breast cancer patients. They were followed for 7 years. During that time, there were almost 1,300 recurrences and about 1,200 deaths. So it really represents a lot of information. And what was found was that women who actually consumed the most amount of soy were less likely to die from their disease and 25% less likely to suffer recurrence. So in contrast to the concern that soy consumption may actually be harmful for breast cancer patients, the most recent evidence indicates that it's actually beneficial for breast cancer patients. And in fact, the American Cancer Society and the American Institute for Cancer Research both concluded in 2012 that soy foods are safe for breast cancer patients.
Do you have a recommended upper limit for how much soy one should consume?
Yes, there is an upper limit, but it's not based on concerns about safety. It's really based on the need to consume all foods in moderation and to eat a very varied diet. So to me, that means that one should really not consume more than 4 servings of soy per day, not because 5 servings is harmful, but because if you're consuming more than 4 servings per day, in my opinion, you're really placing too much emphasis on one particular food.
Our expert today is Dr. Ella Haddad, Associate Professor and Nutritional Biochemist in the Department of Nutrition at the School of Public Health at Loma Linda University. She joins us in our Loma Linda studio. Vitamin B12 is a nutrient that's pretty much absent from a plant-based diet. I asked Dr. Haddad about vitamin B12.
Most of our vitamins come from plants, except for vitamin D, which is in our skin. The other exception is vitamin B12. So whether we're animals or humans, we depend on bacteria to make vitamin B12. Bacteria is the only one of God's organisms that is able to make vitamin B12.
Okay, but if we're eating food, where might we find it in terms of foods then? Because we don't eat, we don't consciously eat bacteria.
Animals like cows and chickens can absorb the vitamin B12 that's synthesized in their GI tracts. They can absorb it from their GI tracts. Us humans, we cannot absorb the B12 that is synthesized in our colons. Somehow the absorption mechanism is higher up in the GI tract. So we usually get vitamin B12 from animal foods, things like meat and chicken and fish, also milk and eggs and milk products like cheese and yogurt would have vitamin B12. Mm-hmm. The other foods will not have vitamin B12 unless they're artificially fortified with vitamin B12.
Okay. Now, what does the body do with vitamin B12? Why does it need it?
Like the other B vitamins, vitamin B12 is what is called a cofactor for the activity of certain enzymes. So there are a couple of reactions in the body that require vitamin B12. And if it isn't there, then a couple metabolites, a couple products accumulate, which are bad. Also, if vitamin B12 isn't there, it's going to affect a couple of metabolic processes.
So which of our systems relies most heavily on vitamin B12?
I think the most important one is probably DNA synthesis. Both DNA synthesis and RNA synthesis depend on vitamin B12. So that's very, very important.
That's right. That's not a particular organ. That's every cell in our bodies requires DNA and synthesis and replication, doesn't it?
Yes, that's correct.
Now, does our nervous system, our brain, our spinal cord, is that particularly sensitive?
That's particularly sensitive, and so are the red blood cells. So those are the two systems that are particularly sensitive to a lack of B12.
Okay. Now, is vitamin B12 a particularly important nutrient in pregnancy?
Yes, because you can imagine the embryo's developing pretty fast, so if it's not getting adequate B12, there's going to be some abnormalities. The other nutrient that is important is folic acid, but now folic acid is being added to grains in developed countries. And that has, you know, the addition of folic acid to grains has reduced the occurrence of neural tube defects. But there are still some happening, and they're finding out maybe B12 is the next thing that we should make sure pregnant women get in order to avoid having babies with neural tube defects.
Which is a pretty devastating abnormality.
It is a pretty devastating abnormality.
What about the elderly? Are they particularly sensitive to deficiencies in B12?
Yes, they are. But before we get to the elderly, breastfeeding babies of women who are not getting enough B12 are also at risk, because apparently what gets into the milk is not so much what the mom stores in her liver, but more what the mom is eating. So if the mom isn't eating enough B12, the baby might not get enough B12 in their breast milk. So both pregnant women and women who are breastfeeding are especially susceptible, and we have to make sure they get adequate B12 in their diet.
So it's in their diet. You're concerned with their stores. If they have stores of B12 that they are actually using up, that won't get through to the baby?
That won't get through to baby's milk. It's strange, but that's what happens.
So someone who has a dietary deficiency, it's really important they know about that before they embark on a pregnancy.
That's right.
And if they're needing to supplement in pregnancy, they should keep supplementing till the end of breastfeeding then.
That's correct.
Now, the Framingham follow-up study showed that B12 was important in a particular age group. Tell us about those findings.
Yeah. B12 for the elderly. I guess this is something that people have known about for a while. As we get older, we're less able to absorb the protein bound or the food bound B12 that is found in things like dairy and eggs and other animal foods. Somehow a reduction in gastric acid as we grow older, then the B12 isn't absorbed as well. So the elderly are at a particular risk. So the question is, you know, a lot of people are getting Alzheimer's and cognitive decline when they get older. So people are wondering, you know, is this a vitamin B12 deficiency or is it other things? Well, no one knows for sure. But one of the Framingham follow-up studies looked at B12 status and the change in cognitive function over a period of time. And those who were deficient in B12 had quicker loss of cognitive function. So at least we can say that B12 deficiency will worsen the cognitive decline. But we don't know exactly whether vitamin B12 deficiency causes cognitive decline.
Right.
Alzheimer's. Those are very complex conditions, and there are many, many other factors.
I'm sure there are, because we're seeing more of it at a younger age also, aren't we?
And
but it sounds as though, because our nervous system is sensitive to deficiencies in B12, it would make sense that if we're on the edge or at risk, then these other factors are very important to be sure that we have adequate amounts in the diet.
That's correct.
Right after the break, we have a delicious asparagus side dish. Don't miss it. Welcome back to Go Healthy for Good, and we're in Phil's kitchen. Phil, I see you're lighting a fire over there. What are you
doing? I told
make
you
for
I like
us?
To have fun in the kitchen.
All right, so what is it today?
Basically, this is going to be roasted asparagus.
Yeah.
And we're going to roast it, and then we're going to put a cashew hollandaise sauce on.
Oh, wow. This sounds
awesome. So it's a little bit healthier than the traditional.
Okay. Well, we better get cracking before
that's right.
it bursts into flame. What's in it?
To start off, what we need is 1 to 2 pounds of asparagus.
Yum.
1 to 2 tablespoons of olive oil, 1/4 cup of raw cashews, 1/4 cup of raw sunflower seeds, 1 to 2 teaspoons of raw sesame seeds, and then salt to taste.
Mm.
And we're also going to need the zest of an organic lemon, juice of a lemon, 2 1/2 tablespoons of nutritional yeast, 1/8 teaspoon of turmeric, and some more salt to taste, and a little bit of olive oil.
All right.
So what I'm going to have you do is I'm going to have you work on the asparagus.
Okay.
And I'm going to go work on our hollandaise sauce over here.
All right.
And
so
to do
I'm
that,
I'm going to put them on the roasting tray then.
That's exactly it. Now, to break them, you just want to kind of break it at the breaking point.
All right.
And that'll get you started. And while you do that, I'm going to slice our shallot. And I'm going to saute this before we mix it in with everything else, just to kind of soften it up.
And it's great to use these ends for making some veggie stock, rather than wasting all that lovely goodness.
That's exactly right. There's a lot you can do, and a lot of these things just go down the garbage disposal.
Mm.
And we're kind of throwing away a lot of great stuff that we can
reuse.
Yeah,
and lots of good nutrients. Now, do you choose particular asparagus for roasting?
You know what? Larger is usually better.
Mm.
The smaller ones can get kind of stringy.
Oh, yeah, they probably dry out some, hey?
So basically, what we've done is we've taken our raw seeds and we've pre-soaked them.
Okay.
And that soaks for about a few hours.
Mm.
And then I'm just going to toss them into here.
So you just cover them with some water and then just throw water and seed and everything in there?
It's that easy.
Wow. Now, do you want me to put some oil and salt on these asparagus before
Please
I roast
do.
Them? Okay.
Now we've got our onions sautéed, so I've thrown those in there.
They smell wonderful.
I'm going to throw in the lemon juice as well. And that's the great thing about onions. They Smells so good when you saute them.
Mm.
Our lemon zest. And these are our, it's our nutritional yeast. And our turmeric. And I'm gonna use a little bit of salt. You wanna do it for taste, but you don't wanna put too much in.
Yeah, that turmeric's gonna make it, give it a lovely color.
That's one thing, I love that taste.
Yeah.
And that color just adds a little bit to it. And then we're gonna puree it.
Okay.
Now you've noticed that I've actually held off on our herbs. Mm. The reason for that is because if you toss them in from the very beginning, you're gonna come up with green hollandaise sauce.
Oh, that would be different, yeah.
And it's typically yellow, and this will give it a little bit of flex if you do it right at the end.
Oh, nice, nice idea.
You can see that basically we've got it done. It's very easy.
Mm.
You want to kind of mix it according to how, I guess, solid or liquid you like it, because
right.
Everybody's got different tastes.
Yeah.
And once you've got that...
Would you water it down with a little bit more lemon juice?
You can use the lemon juice. It may even be a good idea to hold back some of the water that you used for soaking the seeds, and you can use that as well just to make it a little bit more liquid.
Consistency you want. All right, well, I'd better put some salt on these.
That asparagus is looking very good.
Isn't it? Ooh. Now, how long will we put them in the oven for, and what temperature?
Oh, you're going to put them on at about 350,
mm-hmm.
and you want to do it until they're tender. So just take a fork in it, and when you can poke it with a fork and it'll go through, then it's ready.
Oh, I imagine that would only probably take 5-10 minutes, right? Depending
on
how big they are. Wonderful. So, just like that, and that's your sauce done.
Just like that, you put that in the oven, and then we'll move over here and you can see it. And what you want to basically do is just mm-hmm. take our sauce and put a dollop on it.
Mmm.
And then it's ready.
Wow. Or you could, I suppose, make it thinner and
you could
get fancy.
Exactly. A little bit of spiral good. Around your plate.
Whoa. Well, this looks fantastic. I'm going to go for the short one. One, two, three. Mmm. That has a wonderful flavor with the herbs. I've never thought of having herbs with asparagus.
Wonderful. And what I love is that you have that hollandaise sauce taste, but it's with different ingredients. It's with the cashews.
And with healthy things instead of, and no saturated fats. This is all monounsaturated, polyunsaturated fats, so that's great.
So you've got a great healthy side dish.
Mmm, you definitely want to try this. Now let's watch a video.
We were totally baffled as we saw the epidemic of heart disease emerging really towards World War II. It was difficult to find heart disease in America before World War I. But gradually it moved into an epidemic proportion, and then people didn't quite know what to do. What is causing this disease? And then came World War II, the largest nutritional experiment ever conducted in the history of the world. What happened? As Nazi armies occupied the Central European and Northern European countries, they took all the livestock from the people. In these occupied countries now, the people had to live on very simple diets. They had to live on foods as grown. They had to live on foods without nutrition labels. Simple foods, whole grains, fruits and vegetables. They had to live on beans, simple foods that you grow in the gardens. And that's what these people had to do because it was wartime. And what happened? Within 1 and 1.5 years, coronary artery disease went way down in these countries. Diabetes went way down. High blood pressure rates went way down. Overweight went down. And all of a sudden, it was amazing to see heart disease dropping off virtually in spite of the war and the stress and everything else. And so in America, we saw just the opposite. In America, we saw the heart disease rates going up and up and up during World War II. And we began to say, what could this be? And so this gave birth to one of the most important studies ever done, the Framingham Study near Boston, which started in 1949. And they enrolled some 5,000 people in the town and followed them for the next 1, 2, 3 generations. And we learned the powerful lesson, and that is heart disease is not so much a genetic problem as it has to do with certain risk factors. It has to do with cholesterol, with smoking, with high blood pressure. It has to do with diabetes. It has to do with overweight, triglyceride, the blood fats. It has to do with stress and an inactive lifestyle. Of course, there are sometimes also some genetic factors, but these are the modifiable factors that we can change. And we learned from the Framingham study that heart disease was a disease of lifestyle. How people live, how people eat, largely determines how people die and when they die.
So put some thought into how you live and how you eat. Now back to our Loma Linda studio with Dr. Ala Haddad from Loma Linda University. I asked her who is at particular risk of vitamin B12 deficiency.
We've just had a congress on vegetarian nutrition.
We have.
And one of the nutrients that is always talked about in the context of vegetarian and vegan diets is vitamin B12. Because as we said earlier in the segment, that the only food sources of vitamin B12 are animal foods. And vegetarian, lacto-ovo-vegetarians will eat only milk and eggs and dairy products. And vegans don't use any animal foods, and they depend solely on plant foods. So where would they get their vitamin B12 since it's not present in plant foods?
Now, were you involved in the Adventist Health Study? Do you know what percentage of vegetarians and vegans were deficient? Was it about 10% or?
About there. Yeah.
But I guess it depends on what level you use as your cutoff.
True. What level you use as your cutoff and whether or not they're eating fortified foods and supplements.
Mm-hmm.
So from the early days when vitamin B12 was being discovered, my mentor, Dr. U.D. Register, who had worked at the University of Wisconsin on vitamin B12 nutrition, kept emphasizing that we really should get B12 into the foods that are commonly used by vegetarians. So he pushed very hard that all meat analogs and dairy substitutes will be fortified with vitamin B12 as a source for people who would like to follow vegetarian and vegan diets. So a lot of vegetarians and vegans do use fortified foods and do use supplements because they know about this problem. Mm-hmm. So the occurrence of B12 deficiency isn't as high as you might expect, but some people still have not got the message, and some people might have other problems, like the elderly with the difficulties they have in absorbing B12.
So if we do have enough hydrochloric acid in our stomach and we've not reached that age, how do we normally absorb vitamin B12?
Wow.
I know, it's a big question, isn't it?
It requires something called intrinsic factor that's produced in the stomach. And the stomach is also important for separating the B12 from proteins and other substances, food components that it might be bound to.
Does that also happen in the mouth, in the saliva?
Very little.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. No, saliva will not digest off the protein.
Okay.
But if you have supplemental B12, you might absorb some in your mouth by diffusion, but very little.
Okay. Yeah. So once it reaches the stomach, then it's separated from a binding protein?
That's right. And the stomach also produces intrinsic factor, but it's lower down, you know, where the pancreatic secretions neutralize the stomach acid, that B12 gets attached to intrinsic factor, and then lower down still, where there are special receptors that take up intrinsic factor with B12 into the intestinal cell and into the blood.
Wow,
so it's a complicated process, yes.
It is complex, isn't it? It's like it goes into the stomach and the golf buggy and the B12 then ride separately as far as the pancreatic juices. Then it hops on, and then it has to hop off further along and then be absorbed.
Actually, the buggy and the B12 get absorbed together.
Very, very complex. Any other vitamins that are that complicated?
I don't think so.
No, yeah. It's unique. So.
It's unique.
Yeah.
And there are many factors that can upset the process. You know, some people are born with antibodies to their intrinsic factors, so they get pernicious anemia early on, which is really vitamin B12 deficiency. But there are other conditions like...
I guess conditions that lower the acidity in the stomach. What about the drugs that lower acidity? Does that have an impact?
That does have an impact, yes.
Wow. Now, there are a lot of people on those medications to lower gastric acidity, aren't there?
Yeah.
We'll come back to the other illnesses in a moment. On the other side of the break, Sean's here to get us off the sofa. But first, the news. We headed to the Loma Linda University School of Public Health to talk to Dr. Nico Reza, who has some new research to tell us about. Dr. Reza, you're here in the Department of Nutrition at the School of Public Health at Loma Linda University, and you're one of the researchers. I'm looking at one of your papers. This is fascinating. Tell me what you were studying here.
So what we were looking here was at dietary patterns, and they were characterized by meat intake. And so we were able to stratify them into vegetarians, semi-vegetarians, those which eat occasionally eat but not regularly, and non-vegetarians who eat regularly meat. And we were specifically looking at how does dietary patterns, how does that relate to the metabolic syndrome?
Yes, because we're getting so much metabolic syndrome now.
And it's very important to look at the metabolic syndrome because it kind of shows how our metabolic systems change, how our HDL levels are, how our waist circumference is, how our total insulin levels are correlating to it. And that is of importance because 78% of those who have the metabolic syndrome, they also have diabetes. And so it's a good indicator of our overall health status is.
So what did you find? How did the dietary pattern relate to those risk factors for metabolic syndrome?
Well, actually, the results were very interesting. And if you maybe turn here this page, we can see how those who were vegetarians had a much lower risk of having the metabolic syndrome than those who were non-vegetarians. But also those who were semi-vegetarians were somehow in the middle, in between. So there was a definite reduction in having the metabolic syndrome if you are a vegetarian.
So what parameters were different in the different groups?
So we must know that the metabolic syndrome is defined by different organizations slightly differently. What we used was the Adult Treatment Panel 3 definition of it. And according to the panel, parts that are part of the metabolic syndrome are HDL, so the so-called good HDL, but you know, we need also the LDL. Without the LDL, we wouldn't survive neither.
Okay.
But it is of importance, especially in prevention of cardiovascular disease and so on. Triglyceride levels, glucose, systolic blood pressure, diastolic blood pressure. You know, you go to the doctor, they measure your blood pressure, and then you have those different variables, and waist circumference, which is also a measure, and it's included in the definition of the metabolic syndrome. And what we found was that waist circumference was significantly lower in those who were vegetarians in comparison to non-vegetarians, which is interesting because overall the caloric intake was the same. And the physical activity, we also adjusted for physical activity and other factors, that was not it, but made a difference. You know, would maybe say, oh, well, the vegetarians in your study, they are maybe also more physically active, and therefore they are maybe less heavy.
Yeah.
But that was not the case. So it was, even though we adjusted for it, the waist circumference and also the BMI, which is not part of the metabolic syndrome, but it's another measure, which is of importance, was lower. And so there is something which has to do with the food pattern, the composition of the food, that is independent of the overall calories, which might make a difference in your overall weight.
Welcome back. Sean, what have you got for us? I like these chairs. This looks like we're going to have a really cruisy exercise session today.
Absolutely. We could just actually sit and lounge.
We could talk about exercise.
We could talk about exercise, but not today.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
All right. You're so mean.
So let's do a nice wide base, all right? What you want to do is nice wide base, take a deep breath. All right, put the hands out. And since we're going to work some chest exercises today, we're going to open and close the chest, all right? What you're doing here is not trying to overexert the muscle, just warm it and prepare it for exercise. Opening the chest up.
Okay.
And then stretching out the scapula area, the back, all right? 3, 2, and 1, okay? Let's do some butt kicks, okay? Just
all
to
right.
get the blood flowing a little bit. 3, 2, and 1, go. You just want to be light on your feet. If you can't handle the impact, okay, just here.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I'm gonna keep on going.
All right.
You can do this for about 30 seconds. After about 10, 15 seconds, actually, you start to feel the body warm up, okay? I'm gonna go 5, 4, 3, 2, and 1, okay?
All right.
So we got these nice cushiony chairs.
Yeah.
We're not gonna sit in them, okay? But we're gonna pretend.
Okay.
But we're gonna work the triceps, okay?
All right.
We're gonna keep the legs about shoulder width apart, parallel, and toes pointing forward.
All right.
The back of your,
sit-upon?
Pants, yes. You call it a sit-upon?
Yes, the sit-upon.
We're gonna go all the way down, let it graze against the chair, and back up, okay? When you get to the top, squeeze your tricep, all right? Let's go for 6, 3, 2, and 1, go. 1. Now, don't do these too fast. 3, 4, 5, I want you to hold it on 6. And squeeze here, okay? The back of the arm is working the entire time, okay?
Mm-hmm.
One more time. All the way down, stretch, 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 and back up, okay? This is working the back of the triceps. Some people call it the hello goodbyes. You know when you're waving it.
Yes.
How do I get rid of these?
That's why the queen does it this way.
Yes.
Didn't you know?
Yeah. All right, so we're going to turn around. Excuse
right.
my back, right? But we're going to go here.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to still work the core, but we're going to work the chest a little bit. We're going to put the right leg up for 2 reps and then the left leg up for 2 reps.
All right.
Okay? 3, 2, put the right leg up. And 1, go. 1, 2, switch, go. 1, 2, switch, go. 1, 2, last set, switch, go. 1, and 2, okay? We're picking up that leg so that we can involve a little bit, some glutes, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And a good way to maximize one exercise and add another one onto it.
Compound
exercise.
Also makes you work your core, doesn't it?
Absolutely.
Because you're not symmetrical.
There
yeah.
you go. Okay.
Yeah.
So what we're going to do next is some in and out, some core workout.
All right.
Exercise, sorry. We're going to sit on the edge of the chair, okay? You could use a bench, but we got a nice cushy chair.
We have.
Yeah. So legs are going to be up here. You're going to sit back a bit, extend it all the way out, and then in, okay? Okay, all the way out. Okay. So in this position here, your legs are working.
Mm-hmm.
Back in, squeeze, try and bring your leg all the way in towards your chest. Back out. Let's do 3, go. 1, 2, and 3, okay? Great exercise to challenge the core, okay?
I love doing that when I'm watching TV.
Really?
Yeah. Not the whole time.
You need to watch some more interesting TV.
Do I?
Yeah. If you can exercise and do that, you need to change the station.
Well, it's not Hope Channel then.
You know, when I'm watching TV, I'm not thinking about any exercise.
Aren't you? Oh, you that's because you do it all day.
Yeah, that's what it is.
Yeah.
I'm like, I just want to sit and veg out a little bit.
All right.
All right, let's stretch it out. Okay. Now, cool down is what? We want to relax.
Yep.
Right? So I like here, stretching it out here.
Yeah, because we used those muscles.
We did. Triceps are nice and engaged. But what I do want you to do, pay attention to this, is don't make this shoulder go all the way up. Relax it down, okay? You don't want it to be up here. You want it to just relax, okay? Let's switch sides. Now, what you could do is take this hand here, these fingers, and reach across the body. You will feel your triceps engage a little bit. Just flex it a little bit. Feel it. Admire your hard work.
Aww.
There you go.
Good muscle.
You can pet your
good muscle.
Tricep. There you go. Pet your tricep, you know? Good tricep.
Sounds like you're petting your dinosaur, your tricep. Yeah.
Shake it out. Now, we started with this, right? And you can finish with this. Okay? Open and close. Feel good?
Very good. Yeah.
Now, you can repeat this for a couple times, three times. You know, you either do it for time or you do it for reps.
Great. Well, thanks, Sean. That was great workout.
Very welcome.
And now let's watch an ageless advantage. And while you sit there, do your scrunches.
Which is better for your bones, dairy or soy milk? As we age, our risk of developing osteoporosis increases, and our dietary choices can make a big difference. The Adventist Health Study found women drinking milk at least once a day had bones that were just as strong whether they drank soy milk or dairy milk. Those drinking milk less than once a day had a significantly higher risk of osteoporosis. Maintaining strong bones is another ageless advantage.
Thank you for your questions. It's time for me to answer some of yours. Kathleen called and asked, as a vegetarian, where should I get my protein from? Well, Kathleen, protein is made up of amino acids and they come from a variety of whole grains and legumes. So mix and match them. Legumes would be beans, peas, soy and tofu. And the whole grains, you know what those are. Someone texted, what's the difference between psoriasis and eczema? Well, psoriasis is an autoimmune disease that causes real thickening of the skin, especially over the outside of the joints. Eczema, on the other hand, is more of an allergy. It's itchy and weeping and happens more often in the creases. Callie asked, which herbs or foods can we concentrate on to help with weight loss, diabetes and high blood pressure, along with exercise? Well, I'm glad you added the exercise there, Callie. Well, whole food, plant-based diets tend to give 10 to 20 pounds less weight. So that's a great way to start and exclude processed foods and of course the animal sourced foods. For blood pressure, focus on eating plenty of garlic and parsley. Thanks for sending those questions. Keep them coming on 855-400-HEALTHY. That's 855-400-4325. Now it's time to learn about butternut squash. This winter squash has a sweet, nutty taste similar to that of a pumpkin. It has yellow skin and has very orange fleshy pulp. When it gets ripe, the colour becomes a deep orange and it gets sweeter and richer. That colour tells us that there are lots of vitamin A and vitamin E in there. But it's also a good source of vitamin C, manganese, magnesium and potassium. If you're low in magnesium, you can get muscle cramps, tingling in the limbs, and severe problems in the nervous system. You can also get a low level of calcium and potassium. One of the most common ways to eat butternut squash is to roast it dry or with a little oil and bake it at 400 degrees for about half an hour. But it also makes a wonderful soup. Just add some herbs or spices to season it and bon appetit. Yum. Now we're back with Dr. Ala Haddad at our Loma Linda studio. We already discussed the complex mechanism by which vitamin B12 is absorbed and how that can be disrupted. I asked Dr. Haddad if there are other causes for the malabsorption of vitamin B12.
Surgery, any surgery in the stomach or the GI tract will affect that. You know, conditions like malabsorption, like colitis, You know, if people have bacterial overgrowth, that might influence that. So there are a number of conditions that affect it.
So like inflammatory bowel disease.
Correct.
And then surgery, if you've had to remove some of that bowel, where it's the critical little segment, the terminal ileum, where the B12's absorbed.
Exactly.
Then you are definitely going to need to have, well, how do you overcome those problems? How do you get enough B12 if you can't take it by mouth?
Yeah, and for people who have a problem with their intrinsic factor, the traditional way is to get B12 by injection. So for example, those who have pernicious anemia and serious malabsorption problems have to have it by injection. But recently, they found out that for the elderly or people with mild malabsorption, that taking large amounts by mouth bypasses the complex system of absorption, and you know, very small amounts get absorbed by diffusion, different parts of the intestinal tract. So now they're studying, you know, the efficiency of absorption of large amounts to help people who might have low blood levels of B12.
Fascinating. Now, how much do we need each day? How much do we need to absorb?
We need to absorb probably about 2-3 micrograms, which is very little. I don't even know how much a microgram is. But
right.
Sometimes you might have to take, you know, 1,000 to 2,000 micrograms regularly if you're older and might have a malabsorption problem in order to overcome this difficulty.
And it's not hard to find those supplements, because if it's B12 on its own in a supplement, it typically is about 1,000, isn't it?
True, and it's not bound to protein, so the body doesn't have to separate it out from the protein. It's just ready to get absorbed.
All right, and so those out of the 1,000, you should be able to absorb 2, 3, 4 micrograms per day.
Yeah.
Right, that sounds great. Now, what's the best way to ensure the rest of us who are not supplementing, perhaps, to find the sources of B12 if we're vegetarian or vegan?
Either have a regular source of B12 fortified food.
What sort of foods would be fortified? I know you mentioned the meat analogs.
Breakfast cereals.
Okay.
But you have to check the label. Many of the soy milks and the other milk alternates would have B12 in them. Nutritional yeast, some people like using that, but it has to say nutritional yeast. It can't be just brewer's yeast. It has to be labeled nutritional yeast to have B12 in it.
And that would have enough bioavailable B12 in it?
Yeah, for people, you know, for healthy people.
Yes.
Yeah.
All right.
For older people, I would really suggest that they get their B12 levels checked by their doctors, and if they're low, then the doctors will try more aggressive ways of making sure they get enough B12.
I'm curious. You know, we only need 2, 3, 4 micrograms a week.
Mm-hmm.
A day. Yeah. I'm sorry. What if we took it once a week? Would that be sufficient?
I think that's sufficient for healthy people.
Right.
So healthy vegetarians, vegans. I'm not saying older people aren't healthy, but...
But they're more at risk, aren't they?
Because of
having less stomach acid.
True.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. And tell me, the levels of vitamin B12 are related to a chemical or a substance called homocysteine. What's that relationship and why is it important?
Enzyme that converts homocysteine to methionine needs vitamin B12. So if we don't have vitamin B12, then homocysteine goes up in the blood. And homocysteine is a bit toxic. It's a known risk factor for cardiovascular disease, for blood clots. So not good to have too much homocysteine around.
Do vegetarians and vegans have higher levels of homocysteine?
I think older people have higher levels.
Okay.
And vegetarians and vegans who are not supplementing properly and whose B12 might be low. It wouldn't be in everybody. It would be just in those who are not making sure they get adequate B12.
So in people who are deficient in B12, do they actually have higher rates of cardiovascular disease?
I don't think anyone has looked at it. Okay. They do have higher rates of thrombosis, but whether that means more heart attacks, I'm not sure of that.
Mm. Oh, those are often related. Our large intestines are loaded with bacteria. The types of bacteria that we carry can either protect us or expose us to disease. Dr. Sharon Ross from the NIH addressed the International Congress on Vegetarian Nutrition, and I asked her to explain more about the interaction between our food, gut bacteria, and disease.
There is some evidence that our gut bacteria plays a role in interacting with a diet, with our diet, different diet constituents, to give rise to different constituents that are then found systemically as metabolites that may go on to do important functions for health. And maybe even on the other, you know, depending on whether this is a beneficial bacteria or a beneficial food, it may even be from a harmful, you know, so it's really specific to the constituent in the bacteria.
Can you tell us which bacteria those might be?
Yeah, it's not my area of expertise, but I know as an example, for the food part of the equation, we have a lot of evidence that short-chain fatty acids, which arise in the gut by bacteria working on fiber to give rise to these short-chain fatty acids, and some of these, such as butyrate, are very important molecular active metabolites. Butyrate is in a number of processes, it's thought to be beneficial for some of this epigenetic stuff that I was talking about. Butyrate may be important in regulating gene expression and function, and in an important regulatory fashion for health. So that's one of the ways maybe fiber is acting in the gut.
What's the interaction between the butyrate and the fiber?
So the interaction is that the fiber gives rise to butyrate with an interaction with the microbiome. So there's and I don't know which bacteria, but some bacteria, we need the enzymes, if you will, not just from us, but from the bacteria, to work on the fiber to give rise to this bioactive constituent butyrate, short chain fatty acid. So it's almost like a fermentation. They also term it as a fermentation in the gut from fiber to give rise to these short chain fatty acids.
So fiber in the diet plus gut bacteria creates the byproduct butyrate, which alters genes and gene switches, which in turn reduce the risk of colorectal cancer. So be sure to eat plenty of fiber and maintain plenty of lactobacillus in your gut. We've been discussing vitamin deficiencies in vegetarians with registered dietitian and biochemist Dr. Ella Haddad. Now we turn from vitamin B12 to vitamin D. I asked her about vitamin D deficiency.
It's also a common problem in the elderly because as we grow older, I guess, we are less able to convert the precursor in our skin to the active vitamin D. Now, vitamin D is another one of those very interesting vitamins because basically we don't depend on it from the food primarily, but from a precursor in our skin that is converted to the action of the sunlight to another compound which is absorbed into the bloodstream. And then, you know, it's activated on by the liver and the kidneys to become the active B12 in our bodies. So that's another complicated process.
Yes, it is. Another complex vitamin. Yeah. Who's more at risk of, you mentioned the elderly. Are there any other groups that are particularly at risk of vitamin D deficiency?
You know, young children and babies. It used to be that children had rickets. A bone deforming disease, and you know these deformities would stay with them for a long time. And in developed countries, of course, many foods became fortified with B12, especially milk and...
Vitamin D.
Vitamin D. Especially milk and margarines. Margarines and milk are fortified with vitamin D.
Mm-hmm. So we're relying more on on fortified foods rather than on getting out into the sunlight?
Because most of us sit indoors, work indoors most of the day.
Right.
Yeah, and there are places in the world that don't get adequate sunlight for adequate vitamin D synthesis. So we still depend on foods and fortified foods.
What is vitamin D important for? What functions in the body?
Bone. Most important for the absorption of calcium to make adequate bone, but also for other systems, especially the immune system and some of the other systems.
Mm. And I think it's also, deficiency has also been linked to higher cancer rates, so we don't know what that linkage exactly is, do we?
That's correct.
Mm. Whether it comes through the immune system. Now, are vegetarians or vegans or other dietary groups more at risk of vitamin D deficiency?
They could be because they would eat less of the of some of the foods that are rich sources of vitamin D.
What might those be? What are the rich sources?
Yeah, we talked about milk, which is fortified. It's not naturally that rich.
Mm-hmm.
But then the butter is a little more, has more, and egg yolks, and liver.
Liver, and I'm thinking cod liver oil,
That's kind of loaded, doesn't it? When you were young. Yeah. Yeah, somehow it gets concentrated in the livers of fish and other seafoods. Mm.
Now, there's an interesting geographical pattern around the world. People who have darker skin are closer to the equator and they get more sunlight exposure. And lighter skinned people are closer to the poles, they get less sunlight exposure. Why did God put us that way on the planet when it comes to this vitamin D story?
Because lighter skinned people absorb more vitamin D from the sun. They can convert it more efficiently from the sun than darker skinned people because they get more sun, so they don't need as much.
Right. And that perhaps gives us the message for those who have darker skin, they really need to think about what their vitamin D levels are, don't they?
True. Because
because then they'll be at risk of
conversion is less. Yeah.
Right. And then you're at risk of the osteopenia, osteoporosis. And I guess for pregnant women, their babies can even be born with rickets.
True. They've been finding cases of rickets, especially among breastfeeding black moms in some places.
Right.
So again.
Supplementation is important.
It is important.
How much should we supplement?
I think the recommendation is around 400 international units.
You don't have to be vegetarian to be deficient in vitamins D and B12, but it certainly puts you at risk. So ask your doctor for a blood test and aim for a level of 50 and 500 for vitamin D and B12 respectively. If you are deficient, increase the number of fortified foods that you consume or simply supplement. For vitamin D, that's probably 3,000 to 4,000 units a day. And for vitamin B12, it's 1,000 micrograms a day. If you're concerned about the future of our planet and whether enough resources will be left for our grandchildren, then join us next time as we discuss food choices with respect to sustainability. Thanks for joining us on Go Healthy for Good. I'll see you then.